I want you to imagine, just for a second, a wild, chaotic, crushing waterfall. Picture thousands of gallons of freezing water violently smashing against jagged rocks, throwing up this deafening, blinding roar of mist.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is an intense image.
Right. So do you have that untamed, overwhelming image in your head? Good. Now, I want you to imagine using that exact image of indomitable, chaotic power to symbolize the ultimate feeling of safety and security. I mean, a marriage proposal.
I mean, let's be real. That sounds like a total contradiction on a psychological level.
Right.
When we think of romance or, you know, making a lifelong emotional commitment to another person, our brains naturally drift toward environments we can control.
Yeah, exactly. Like a quiet sunset on a secluded beach.
Right. Or maybe a perfectly manicured botanical garden. We look for serene spaces where humanity has essentially paved over the unpredictability of the wild.
It feels completely counterintuitive, yet the artist we are focusing on in today's deep dive looked at that roaring, freezing chaos and saw the perfect blueprint for a lifelong commitment.
It's just wild to think about it that way.
It really is. Today, we are exploring how a vibrant, overwhelming forest landscape actually acts as a complex psychological map. We're going to see how raw, untamed nature might just be the most accurate mirror for our deepest personal relationships.
And we have a really incredible stack of sources today to help us decode this. We are looking at a high-resolution image of a watercolor painting titled Olea 2 by the artist Jarrow Duque.
Which is just stunning on its own.
Oh, absolutely. But what makes this exploration truly special is that we aren't just looking at the finished canvas. We also have access to a rare, invaluable set of the artist's own personal notes, his technical specifications, and even his private self-critiques of the work.
Okay, let's unpack this, because it is so incredibly easy to walk past a painting of a forest in a gallery and just think, oh, look, some trees and some water.
Yeah, you just glance at it like a decorative window or something.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you completely miss the philosophical dissertation hiding in the brushstrokes. Our mission today is to decode that hidden language. Every leaf, every shadow, every single drop of painted water in Olea 2 carries massive narrative weight.
Heavily coded, yeah.
And to understand why this landscape feels so emotionally charged, we have to start by figuring out where and when this image was born. Because the geography of this painting is actually split completely in two.
The origin story is absolutely vital here. Because you have to separate the inspiration from the execution. According to the artist's notes, the painting was physically created in August of 2022.
Okay.
And the location was a studio in Whittier, California.
Which is very much an urban-controlled environment. A studio in Whittier is the artist's workspace. It's an architectural bubble.
It is the ultimate laboratory. It's a space where he isolates himself from the outside world to carefully, you know, methodically mix pigment and water.
Yeah.
But that physical location changes how we read the painting, because the actual visual spark the emotional catalyst for the image happened somewhere entirely different.
Oh, really? Where?
The notes reveal that the reference image was a photograph taken by Daniel Duque during a walk in the woods up in Portland, Oregon.
So the original moment is a highly private snapshot. It captures Daniel and Olea at this massive, pivotal life moment, standing right on the threshold of deciding to commit to marriage.
Exactly. It's an intimate, frozen second in a rainy, chaotic northern forest.
I look at it like taking a wild seed from a damp, untamed forest in Portland and carrying it in your pocket all the way down to a highly controlled creative bunker in California just to carefully mathematically cultivate it under artificial lights.
Cultivate is a brilliant way to phrase it. The artist specifically notes that this painting is not intended to be a literal copy of a vacation photo.
Right, it's not just reproducing a picture.
No, it's meant to be a living metaphor of a love that has been nurtured over years, finally reaching a point of maturity and hope. He is basically engineering an emotion.
But that brings up a really obvious question for me. If this painting is fundamentally a celebration of human commitment, of two people deciding to spend their lives together, why didn't the artist make the humans the massive center of the portrait?
That's the big question.
You know, like a traditional engagement photo where the couple's faces take up the entire frame and the trees are just a blurry, insignificant backdrop.
That is the pivotal conceptual choice the artist makes. He categorically refuses to relegate nature to a simple backdrop. Instead of putting the humans front and center, he makes the wildness of the landscape the very manifestation of the life energy that connects them.
So the landscape is the relationship.
Exactly. The roaring water, the dense vegetation that is their bond visualized. Yeah. But Conceptualizing a dense living forest as a metaphor for love is one thing. Actually building it physically, drop by drop, is an entirely different battle.
Especially considering the medium. Looking at the artist's notes, he chose to paint this incredibly dense, heavy forest using watercolor. Doesn't that sound like a recipe for disaster? I mean, watercolor's thin. It's notorious for being uncontrollable and translucent.
It is.
If you try to paint miles of dark, heavy woods, aren't you basically guaranteeing the whole thing turns into a soaked, muddy puddle?
You've just hit on the great, frustrating paradox of watercolor as a medium. The artist had to capture an incredibly heavy, dense subject using a medium defined entirely by its lightness and transparency.
Right. So how do you even do that?
The solution to that paradox requires immense patience and a very strict structural plan. It starts at the paper. The specs note, he used a 300-gram cold-pressed paper.
Wait, why does the weight and the cold-pressed part matter so much? Is it just about durability?
Well, it is about durability, but it's also about architecture. Mm. A 300-gram paper is incredibly thick, almost like firm cardboard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it has to be that thick to hold the sheer volume of water required without warping, buckling, or just disintegrating into pulp. And the cold-pressed aspect means the paper has a distinct, bumpy texture.
Okay, I can picture that.
It has these microscopic valleys and peaks that physically hold the pools of water and pigment in place.
Okay, so the foundation is literally built to hold a flood. But how do you build up those incredibly dark shadows in the deep forest without losing the light?
That's the trick, isn't it?
Because in watercolor, you aren't painting with white paint to create light. The light comes from the white of the paper underneath, shining through, right, like a stained glass window.
That is a perfect analogy.
Mm-hmm.
The paper is the sun behind the stained glass. To preserve that inner light, the artist used a technique involving overlapping washes, which he calls aguadas.
Okay.
He would apply a very light, translucent layer of water and pigment. And this is where the extreme, almost agonizing patience comes in. He had to wait for that layer to dry completely. Absolutely completely.
Oh, man. So if he gets impatient in that Whittier studio and drops wet paint onto a layer that's even slightly damp, what happens?
Total disaster. The colors bleed together across those microscopic valleys in the paper. The pigments mix uncontrollably. And you get that muddy, opaque blob you mentioned earlier.
It just ruins it.
Instantly. You instantly kill the luminosity. The light can no longer shine through. But by strictly respecting the drying time, layer after agonizing layer, the white light of the paper continues to bounce up through those transparent pigments.
That sounds exhausting.
What's fascinating here is how he also manages the viewer's visual stamina through these layers. If you look closely at the foliage, the artist manipulated the depth of field.
What do you mean?
Well, the leaves in the sharp foreground are highly detailed, but the background foliage is painted very loosely, with soft, undefined edges.
Wait, let's break that down for a second. Why wouldn't you want every single leaf to be perfectly detailed? If he's already spending hours layering paint, why let the background go blurry?
It's a technique called atmospheric perspective. In the real world, when we look at objects far away, we are looking at them through layers of air, moisture, and dust. That physical atmosphere scatters the light, making distant objects look blurrier, lighter, and less detailed. The artist is artificially replicating this optical phenomenon on a flat piece of paper.
Oh, that makes total sense, because if every single leaf in a dense forest miles into the distance was painted with hyper-realistic microscopic detail, our brains wouldn't know what to focus on.
Because
our eyes would be completely exhausted. The painting needs to breathe.
It prevents total visual overload. But while building that dark, deep forest required immense patience and layering, capturing the violent, chaotic waterfall right in the center of the painting required a completely counterintuitive technique.
Which was what?
He had to capture all that roaring energy by essentially painting nothing.
Okay, I hear what you're saying about painting nothing, but realistically, it's just blank paper. How does simply leaving the paper naked actually convey the deafening roar of water?
It sounds weird, I know.
Doesn't it just look unfinished? Like he accidentally skipped a spot in the middle of the canvas?
It would look unfinished if it weren't for the surrounding contrast. In traditional watercolor, you don't use a tube of opaque white paint to create highlights.
Right, no white paint.
Right. The absolute purest, brightest white available to you is the raw, untouched paper itself. So to paint the crashing, explosive foam of the waterfall, the artist used a technique known as reservas de papel, paper reserves.
So he essentially has to build a fence around the water in his mind before he even starts.
Exactly. Think about the mental toll and the anticipation required for that. Before a single drop of green or brown hits the paper, he has to visualize exactly where every major splash, every mist cloud, and every drop of foam is going to fall.
That's insane.
And he has to leave those exact spots perfectly, immaculately blank throughout the entire weeks-long process of painting the forest around it.
That sounds incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
One stray drop of dark green pigment flying off the brush, and your bright, pure white waterfall is permanently ruined. You can't just erase it.
You can't. It's a total high wire act. And to answer your question about how it doesn't just look like a blank hole in the paper to give that white space volume and movement so it actually looks like crashing water, he fluted these ultra-thin grayish-blue glazes around the blank reserves.
Oh, I see.
He calls them veladuras. These delicate glazes act as shadows within the water. The sharp contrast between the raw white paper and those subtle blue-gray shadows creates a three-dimensional movement. It makes the water feel alive. His notes describe the water as almost sonorous.
You really do feel like if you lean in close enough to the paper, you can hear it crashing and echoing off the canyon walls.
You really do.
Here's where it gets really interesting, structurally speaking. My eye goes straight to this tiny explosion of intense warmth. The vast majority of this 11 by 15 painting is dominated by massive, cold colors.
Right, lots of cool tones.
We have deep greens, pure blinding whites, and those grayish blues you just mentioned. But right in the dead center, on the rocks where Daniel and Aaliyah are sitting, there are rich earth tones, reddish browns, and one of the figures is wearing a bright yellow shirt.
Yes.
Why put that intense, concentrated warmth right in the middle of a freezing, violent waterfall? What is he trying to say there?
It is a masterful use of human biology and color psychology.
Mm-hmm.
The human eye is biologically programmed to search for warm colors when it's scanning a sea of cold tones.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's an evolutionary trait. Those reddish browns and that pop of bright yellow act as a literal visual magnet. Even though the couple is minuscule in scale, your eye is dragged straight through the chaos and directly onto them.
So it's forcing us to look at them. But psychologically, isn't it also creating a safe zone?
How do you mean?
It feels like the painting is saying, yes, the world is massive and cold and chaotic, but right here on this specific rock between these two specific people, there is warmth and sanctuary.
That is the exact emotional translation the artist is going for. He is mapping out an emotional refuge, and he reinforces that safe zone through the hidden geometry of the painting.
Geometry?
Yeah, compositionally, that loud white waterfall acts as a strong vertical column of gravity, pulling everything aggressively down. But it's crossed by converging diagonal lines created by the rocks and the leaning foliage.
And those diagonals point right at the couple.
They do more than point. They literally cradle them. The underlying geometry of the landscape holds them securely in the center of the chaos.
Okay, but if this couple has their own bright, warm, safe zone created by the geometry and the color, they still look incredibly vulnerable. We mentioned earlier that they are tiny.
Very tiny, yeah.
A microscale couple against a macroscale landscape. Why make them so small if this painting is about the strength of their bond?
We know from the notes it wasn't just to show off his landscape skills. The microscale of the humans is a profound philosophical statement on humility.
Humility, I like that.
It's a total rejection of the modern anthropocentric idea that humanity dominates nature. In Aaliyah 2, the humans aren't conquering the waterfall. They aren't taming the forest. They belong to it.
It reframes the entire concept of love, really.
It really does. The painting makes this beautiful overarching argument that human love, as powerful and all-consuming as it feels to us individually, is really just one small expression of a much vaster, universal force of life that sustains the entire planet.
It's a very grounding thought. Our personal milestones are just one small part of the Earth's heartbeat.
Absolutely.
But even with all this incredible conceptual depth, all this perfect geometry, the tension of the paper reserves and the color psychology, the artist's own notes reveal something kind of shocking. He wasn't completely satisfied with the final piece.
The self-critique section of his notes is a rare treasure. Usually artists only present the polished final product and hide the struggle.
Right. They don't want you to see the mistakes.
Exactly. But here he admits that looking back, he felt the technical transition between that sharp foreground foliage and the soft, loose background could have been smoother.
Really?
Yeah. He felt that if he had refined those transitional layers just a bit more, it would have enhanced that illusion of atmospheric depth even further.
So what does this all mean? To me, it reminds me of a musician who writes this sweeping epic symphony that moves an entire concert hall to tears. People are weeping in the aisles because the emotion is so raw.
Oh, yeah.
But the musician is just sitting in the sound booth, obsessing over the fact that they should have adjusted the bass reverb slightly in the second movement.
That is the perfect way to look at it.
It highlights such an important truth about art. For the creator, the work is a living organism. It is never, ever truly finished in their eyes.
It is the eternal curse of the creator. Your eye always goes to the flaw, to the millimeter of paint that didn't do exactly what you wanted. But importantly, his self-critique doesn't override his overall pride in the piece.
Right. He still loves it.
He recognizes in the notes that he successfully translated a highly complex raw emotion into a physical object without relying on cheap cliches. There are no literal hearts carved into the trees here.
Right.
The emotion is carried entirely by the sheer force of the natural elements.
And the global art world clearly agreed that he succeeded, because this painting didn't just stay hidden away in that Whittier, California studio where he was critiquing the background leaves.
No, it didn't.
The notes document that in October 2023, Alia 2 was packed up and exhibited halfway across the world. It was shown at the Thompson Gallery in Zug, Switzerland, through an organization called Artsboxy.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, think about the incredible narrative trajectory of this single image. It is an act of geographical and emotional alchemy.
Yeah.
It starts as a highly intimate, private conversation between two people walking in the woods in Portland, Oregon. A digital snapshot freezes it. That digital seed travels south to a closed-door studio in California.
And it gets painted.
Right. There, using complex calculations of water weight, raw paper reserves, and pigment, that private memory is engineered into a physical object.
And then that physical object travels thousands of miles across an ocean to a gallery in Switzerland, surrounded by a completely different culture and environment.
And yet the people in Switzerland can stand in front of it and instantly decipher the intimacy and the commitment of a couple from Portland.
Because it's universal.
Exactly. It proves that when human emotion is masterfully encoded into art, especially using the shared biological language of nature, it completely pulverizes borders. The language of a wild waterfall and the human need for a warm rock translates absolutely anywhere on Earth.
It takes a hyper-specific, deeply personal anecdote and turns it into a universal truth, which really changes how we should look at a piece of art like this the next time we're in a gallery.
It demands that we look deeper than the surface aesthetic.
Looking at Alia 2 isn't just about admiring technical skills. We aren't just marveling at how a guy in a studio figured out how to make a 300-gram piece of cold-pressed cardboard look like a roaring, sonorous body of water.
Though again, the sheer patience required for that is incredibly impressive.
Oh, completely. But it's about seeing how those physical tools, the overlapping washes, the stressful paper reserves, the warm earth pigments, are used to explain the human condition.
The natural landscape literally becomes a vocabulary for the things we struggle to say out loud to each other.
Alia 2 reminds us that love doesn't have to be a quiet, orderly, manicured garden to be real. It can be as immense, uncontrollable, and forcefully life-giving as a wild waterfall.
Yes.
And it reminds us that we are lovingly sustained by the natural world, cradled by its geometry, not floating somewhere above it in control.
It completely reframes our place in the world, both as partners to each other and as temporary inhabitants of a much larger planet.
And that brings us to a final thought for you to take away today. We've spent this deep dive exploring how Jairo Duke used the specific topography of a dense, rainy forest and a violent waterfall to map out a lifelong commitment.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, if you had to paint your own most intimate memory, a moment where you forged an unbreakable emotional alliance with someone, and you could only use the elements of nature to represent it, what landscape would you choose?
Would it be the violent churning clash of an ocean storm off a rocky coast?
Or maybe the absolute still calm and blistering heat of an endless desert? Or perhaps an unmovable, silent, snow-capped mountain? Take a second to picture it. And most importantly, what would that specific topographical choice say about your own unique way of loving?
It's a profound question to sit with. Our inner emotional states always have a physical counterpart in the wild.
Something to mull over the next time you find yourself standing in front of a wild, chaotic, crushing waterfall. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.